Accession number 28410, Reel 5.
Sorry, continue. You were talking about the Bren gun carrier.
On another occasion...
Finish that story.
Well, I'm continuing. I just discovered a disabled Bren gun carrier. A number of the people on board had been killed. One of the survivors actually handed me a British 45 Webley and Scott pistol that was lying on the ground, which had belonged to one of the crew of the tank who had been killed. We frequently, in the campaign, in the central section there, picked up weapons of one sort or the other, which had been carried by people during engagements and who had been killed, and we picked these things up to prevent them falling into the hands of people who might have used them against us.
What, given your situation, I mean, you are now fighting a real war and you're experiencing dead and wounded. What was it like to be experiencing people that have been killed in action for the first time?
Well, unfortunately, or fortunately, whichever way you put it, the troop that I was with were in a reserve situation for most of the Syrian campaign. And the only thing we were subject to was heavy bombardment from French 75mm guns. These artillery pieces were the First World War type 75mm guns. The gunners were very skilled and their fire very accurate. Fortunately, we were not, insofar as I'm concerned, as far as my troop was concerned, of four guns, none of us were killed, wounded, or disabled. On another occasion, we actually moved up to provide support to apparently an Australian infantry attack on French positions, and as our role was defence against tanks, we were moved by the officer in command of us into a disused railway cutting, and in effect we were sort of hiding in this cutting, waiting for the appearance of enemy tanks. No tanks appeared. But we were joined by some Bren gun carriers who also moved into this cutting. And at about that stage, the French were obviously bracketing the cutting we were in with heavy fire from their 150mm howitzers. So we progressively watched while these very large shells were bursting either in front or behind us in the cutting and gradually getting closer to where we were. It was at this stage that a number of us took temporary shelter under a Bren gun carrier. In point of fact, we must have flattened out something like lizards or snakes, because it's hard to conceive when you look at a Bren gun carrier that we're able to lie underneath it. during this stage of this particular action, one shell severely damaged my gun-towing truck to the extent that it was not feasible to operate it efficiently, and I was given permission to, if I could, withdraw my gun using the disabled truck to pull it out. The truck's wheel was damaged severely by the shell splinters to the extent that we were not able to replace the wheel, and so drove out with a tireless, very bent wheel, which was later replaced by one of the mobile mechanical units who had great difficulty in...
Sorry, you were telling us about the damaged vehicle. It sounds as though we've got a vehicle driving off now.
Yes, well, we withdrew back to our regular gun position.
What was it like to be in a situation where you're experiencing gunfire for the first time?
Well, I think we mean the bursting of shells in close
Either.
Proximity.
Artillery or small arms?
Well, you didn't particularly notice small arms fire unless you were being directly fired at. But insofar as artillery is concerned, the shells bursting anywhere near you were rather worrying. The noise and the shell splinters splaying in all directions were a worry. As I said previously, we were fortunate insofar as my troop was concerned in that we had no casualties in my troop.
But seeing casualties amongst other troops, how did that make you feel?
Lucky. Compared to others. For example, as I mentioned earlier, four of our guns were disabled and a number of the crew killed. We didn't personally see this happen, but saw the aftermath of it when we moved up past that area later. The anti-tank guns of 7 Battery were responsible, probably during the short Syrian campaign, responsible for possibly putting out of action 15 French tanks. And two officers received military crosses for the action of guns under their command in action against tanks, which prevented the tanks attacking the Australian infantry.
As I understand, everyone thought that the campaign would be over shortly after it had begun. Allies hoped that the Vichy French forces would surrender after token resistance.
This turned out to be quite incorrect. If the Syrian campaign was won by any particular section of the forces which invaded Syria. It was won by the Australian 25-pounder field artillery batteries. They were considered to have been unable to manoeuvre around the mountain roads in the area we invaded. But they managed to do this by uncoupling their guns from tow trucks and manhandling them round narrow corners and so forth. And their impact on both the coastal and Merjeun sectors on the French was incredible. For example, quite frequently, a battery of guns would fire salvos of up to 300 rounds over a period of time, bringing a tremendous concentration down on the enemy, on the coast, for example, on the Litani River area at Damour, and in the Merjeun sector, where an artillery officer named Cutler, later Sir Roden Cutler, Governor of the State of New South Wales in Australia, received the Victoria Cross for his action as a observation post officer for a field artillery regiment and for other actions during the campaign.
People talk of the Vichy French recognising their allies from the First World War. What were you told about that?
Very little. Very little at the time.
I hope that they would recognise their allies and literally put down their guns.
Well, that was the theory. It didn't work that way.
What were you told about this theory? I understand you were asked to wear your felt hats.
That's about all we were told. And we did, in fact, wear our felt hats for a very, very limited period and put them down and put on our steel helmets virtually as soon as we crossed the border, when we were subject to artillery fire in particular from the French. We were also, on occasions, subjected to aerial bombs dropped by French Glen Martin bombers. The French planes had the circular red, white and blue markings, similar to British planes, except that the colours were the other way. In other words, if red was in the centre of the British, it was the outside one of the French. I can't remember the specific details, but I do recall being in a gun position with my individual anti-tank gun at one stage when one of these twin-engine bombers came over, and we saw these markings and thought it was one of our planes, when we noticed that the bomb bays opened and saw a bomb discharged. This exploded not very far from my gun and blew an enormous crater into which my whole gun crew dived, realising that the second bomb wasn't going to fall in the same position. None of my crew were hurt. There was no action we could take against the bomber because we could not elevate the anti-tank gun to a sufficient degree to fire at the the plane.
Now, this being fired, sort of shot at from the air, the advantage that the enemy had in that regard, I understand the most troubling of all forms of attack was to be attacked from the air.
Yes, well, unfortunately, or fortunately, that's the wrong expression. Fortunately, my gun, and as far as I am aware, the other three guns of my troop were not subjected to aerial machine gunning in the Syrian campaign. Some were, but there was not very extensive use of aerial attack during the Syrian campaign. A number of French planes were, as I recall, shot down by Beaufort's guns, manned either by Australian or other troops. But I didn't actually see this take place. It must be remembered that the Syrian terrain was extremely mountainous, with ravines and gullies and rocky outcrops. We were not in open country, and one's view was frequently quite limited. There were problems of supply to Australian troops. In retrospect, it would have been easier to supply our troops with mules than it was with vehicles because of the terrain they were located in. At least one of the guns in the battery of anti-tank guns that was involved was forgotten by the infantry platoon or company officer they were supporting when the infantry withdrew, and the gun and its crew were stranded somewhere in enemy territory for about 3 days without supplies. This proved quite a problem until they were rescued by their own anti-tank group.
The Vichy French, obviously far more stubborn than anyone had counted on.
Well, they were Foreign Legion troops in the main. They were mercenaries. They were professional soldiers. And they consisted of assorted nationalities, and their North African troops were also, I would assume, professionals.
Let's talk about your column and its route. As you were mentioning earlier.
Yeah, well, as I say, we moved into Syria through the northern town of Matalla in Palestine, and the fort of Merjaoun was visible on hills in the distance at the end of a valley. We were to move up that valley, which was subject to defence by the French in Merjayoun at the end of the valley and in forts on either side of the valley, like Khayyam, Cleit, and as I recall, Ibn Saki. These small forts were, in our view, similar to pre-war Foreign Legion book pictures of square forts with an entrance into the inner quadrangle for horses and vehicles, etc. And they were in on hilly positions and proved to be difficult to attack. All were subsequently captured by Australian forces with quite some losses. The anti-tank gunners played perhaps only a minor role in attacks in some of these areas on the forts by firing their two-pounders at machine gun nests hidden in rocky areas, which the Australians would have had to advance across.
Merjayoun was taken on the 19th of June, I understand. And as you mentioned, Lieutenant Cutler had won the Victoria Cross at Merjayoun.
Well, he'd run it, not necessarily at Merjayoun, but for an action including Merjayoun.
Okay.
That Merjayoun was captured twice. In other words, it was captured and abandoned after a counterattack and then recaptured later. The story of the Syrian campaign is very well told by an intelligence officer of one of the infantry battalions. In his book called, if I remember correctly, Mostly a Gamble, in which he quoted what General Thomas Blamey said about the move into Syria being mostly a gamble because we were probably under strength for the attack, considering the nature of the defences available to the French.
You're mentioning, obviously, this counterattack, and as I understand, the Vichy French launched a counterattack in the rear flank of the Damascus Column that broke through to the 25th Brigade's line of advance.
Yeah, well, I can't comment on the Damascus sector. That was away to the east, and at the time we were operating in the Merjayoun sector, none of our regiments' anti-tank guns were involved in the Damascus area.
Well, I understand that the town of Merjayoun was recaptured before the counterattack lost its impetus. And soon after, Wilson was replaced by Laverack. Do you know anything about this at all?
Well, we wouldn't have known anything about that at the time as to who was being replaced in the upper echelon of command.
Can you describe to us the operation of an anti-tank gun? You mention its position. You mentioned it often takes position close to the front line, but how do you actually fire the thing?
Well, the two-pounder anti-tank gun was towed initially by small utility trucks, and by what's called the trail of the gun, which hooked onto a tow bar at the rear of the truck, and it was brought up to a site where it was decided it was needed for defence. And the two wheels of the gun were removed by putting a short pole into a socket near the wheels. While crew lifted it, the wheel was removed, and then a hinged area was swung out and became the support for that side of the gun. The same thing was done on the other side, so eventually your gun was sitting on three points: the trail, which was on the ground, and then these two arms that were swung out with feet on them that held the gun. And the gun could be traversed through 360 degrees by the operators. The gun had a telescopic sight, which was operated, and the gun was operated by a man sitting on a seat. He aimed the gun through the telescopic sight and fired the gun by pressing a pedal. When he was given the okay to fire by a tap on the shoulder from the sergeant in charge of the gun, or the bombardier behind him, the breech was one of that type that you pulled a lever and it dropped down. The shell was placed in by a loader and closed, and the crew, when observed to be clear of the breech, were clear of the recoil of the gun, which came back very forcibly when the gun was fired. The two-pounders were fitted with a tracer so that you could watch the armor-piercing shell as it left your gun. One of the difficulties of using a tracer of this nature was, of course, that it also pinpointed where your gun was insofar as the enemy was concerned, whom you were firing at.